Al-Shabaab group, and they fear they might come back to the British mainland to commit terrorism. But are the security services casting their net too wide? Are they radicalizing a whole community by their aggressive coercion tactics? And what will be the consequences? The Somali community here in the UK numbers in around the hundreds of thousands. Most live in London, but there are also major populations in other major British cities such as Birmingham, Manchester and Sheffield. Many Somalis came here to the UK to flee the brutal civil war, which has ripped their country apart over the past few decades. But once here, many have found life anything but easy. Young Somalis come to this community centre in East London several evenings a week to socialise with their peers and elders. Many have got mixed up with gangs and low-level crime, and will be getting into trouble on the streets if it weren't for this temporary refuge. Here they have something constructive to do, something which fills their time and gives them direction.
This place is a very good place for young people to be coming here every time. Like all my friends, all my brothers come here every time to waste time a lot, play game. By the time it finishes, the run finishes around 10 o'clock. Everyone goes to go home.
And if this place didn't exist, what would happen?
Probably be on the road, fighting a lot, terrorising people. Probably on the public buses, especially the 16, 17-year-olds that's here now.
These boys and young men are streetwise. The area is dominated by deprived estates, bad schools, gang culture and knife crime. And they have a fractious relationship with the authorities, especially the police, who often stop and search them for knives.
What's your problem with the police?
They obviously, we get sub searched on a regular basis for no reason. They think we've got knives and stuff on us for no reason. And then that's it, we just get harassed by them.
Why do they do that?
Because we roll in groups, roll in big, large groups.
Does it happen all the time? How often does it happen?
Every 2 days. Yeah, every 2 days.
How old were you when it happened to you the first time?
Must be 13.
I mean, are you guys carrying knives or what?
They're not finding any when they search us, so what do I say?
How does that make you feel, getting stopped and searched all the time? When
it makes us paranoid, doesn't it? Obviously, every second, every time we're looking over our shoulder, we think we're going to get someone searched.
Imagine there's a group of us over there, and there's a group of white youths over there. They'll come stop and search us.
Because of the colour of your skin?
Yeah, the colour of our skin.
Yeah, I mean, also, I've been hearing stories about the police, asking Somalis to, spy on each other. Have you heard those stories or not?
Yeah, I think I have. In that area, they've quite a lot of Somalis watching what other Somalis do.
Really?
Yeah.
So even within your own community, you don't trust each other?
No. Don't trust no one.
The sense of grievance amongst Somali youth is palpable. Some of these young men feel the obstacles in their way to succeeding in life are huge. Others are more optimistic. But all feel that if they do succeed, it'll be in spite of the authorities rather than because of them. Ibrahim Sincere's parents are from Mogadishu. He's a student and spoken word artist who writes poetry about the issues facing black and Muslim communities in the UK. He feels that Somali youth face a double discrimination in Britain.
Somalis are black and Muslim, and there's a lot of policies that target the black community, and then there's a lot of policies, or even policing policies, that target the Muslim community. And Somalis are black and Muslim.
Ibrahim, like every other Somali I met during the course of this documentary, is also concerned about the confrontational relationship between Somali youth and the police.
It's a psychological war, and I think that a lot of non-white people are very, they feel very discriminated against, and their own worth or their own value is being attacked a lot as well. And I think psychologically, when someone's value is being attacked a lot, or someone's self-worth is being put under scrutiny, that person may look for someone else that he can kind of transfer the weight onto.
Somali youths have split identities. On the one hand, many are born and bred in Britain and they're marginalised from mainstream British society. On the other hand, many identify very strongly with back home. and express a longing to go back there. But back home is a very troubled place indeed. Somalia has been without an effective central government since 1991. Years of fighting between rival warlords and an inability to deal with famine and disease have led to the deaths of up to 1 million people. In 2004, the main warlords and politicians signed a deal to set up a new parliament, but the weak administration has faced a formidable task in bringing reconciliation to a country divided into clan fiefdoms. The Western and African Union-backed government is struggling to achieve stability in the face of persistent attacks by the Al-Shabaab group, which declared allegiance to Al-Qaeda in 2012. Meanwhile, war and poverty have led to the mass exodus of Somalis to surrounding countries and to the West, including the UK. As for the British government, they've become very interested in this Horn of African nation, on the face of it due to the threat of international terrorism and piracy. But many believe the huge energy reserves that lie off the coast of Somalia may have something to do with it. Britain's interest in Somalia was on display at this London conference in May 2013, where major nations came together to agree practical measures to support the Somali government's plans in security, justice, and public financial management.
Today, I think we are seeing the beginnings of a new future for Somalia. Extremism is in retreat. AMISOM, together with Somali and Ethiopian forces, have driven Al-Shabaab out of town after town. Piracy attacks are down by 80%, with no vessel attacked so far this year.
We need support, we need assistance and investment, and we need protection from those who try to knock us over.
Government is moving ahead. Under the guidance of the UN and the African Union and IGAD, the transitional government that lasted 8 years has ended, and now there is a proper, legitimate and federal government in its place.
But outside the conference, not everyone was singing from the same hymn sheets.
Hundreds of Somalis living here in the UK have turned up to protest about the Somalia conference that's taking place here in Lancaster House in London. Some are warning about British imperialism in the region, while others are saying that the president of Somalia, Britain's major ally, is pursuing a clan-based agenda in the country.
The reason I'm here today is to show my feeling, to talk about the unity of Somalia. That's the main message. We want to be united. We don't want our country to be divided into two or three or four.
Somali community, they want to go back to Somalia. Everybody had enough. Where is the people back him killing? Nobody want to stay here. It's a very weird country. The culture is different. Village is different. Everything in here is different. Everybody want to be Somalia so they can go back home.
Do you trust Britain's intentions in Somalia?
I do trust them, but at the same time, is UK government, they don't know nothing about Somalia. So that's why we're telling the Somali president to bring all clients to the table.
What was apparent from this demonstration was that Somalis in the UK are mistrustful of Britain's intentions and are divided over the political direction of their country. Many wanted to go home to help build the nation, but most felt the country was still too unstable. All, however, emphasised that Somali culture and religion is moderate and that Al-Shabaab's extreme Salafi Takfiri ideology was something alien to their nation. They also downplayed the number of young Somalis who were attracted to Al-Qaeda and who were willing to travel to Somalia to fight for Al-Shabaab. My interest in making this documentary stemmed from this public meeting in central London in early 2013. The majority of people here were Somalis, and the issues raised were all to do with MI5 blackmail and the targeting of the community. The aim was to empower British Somalis to come up with a cohesive strategy to counter the harassment. The message was, don't be afraid to speak out, don't be victims. And this is also Abuka Awale's message. He works with British Somali youth and has his own TV show on the Somali channel, where he tries to keep young people on the straight and narrow.
If you are Somali and you go, it doesn't matter where you go, as long as you land in Heathrow Airport, you are expected to be taken on the side not only search by his bags and who you are, but they will have your details, and there is follow-up calls, and yeah, they want you to maybe to have a tea. What is the tea for? And before you know, they will try to push you to say, we want you to become, work with us. And that's what the young people have been complaining so much about.
Awali recognises that the government has a duty to protect national security, but thinks that making an enemy out of a whole community isn't the way to go about doing that.
There are extremists everywhere. Obviously, we cannot deny the fact that Al-Shabaab is in Somalia and they're using similar approaches. But what security services are concerned about, those Al-Shabaabs coming here. Well, we don't have Al-Shabaabs here. We rather have we have boys who are more Arsenal fans rather than Al-Shabaab fans.
What would you have the government do?
Working with the community, winning hearts and minds of young people and encouraging them to report crime, encouraging them to work with the police, to trust the police. I don't think no young, single, whether young and old, Somalis want to see a London being blown away by terrorists. But if the police and security services are victimizing me and making me feel that I am a terrorist, which I am not, then they are pushing me to become a terrorist.
But amid all the doom and gloom, there are signs that the Somali community is trying to channel itself in a positive way. This youth event in the small heath area of Birmingham is a bit of light relief for these young Somalis, who might otherwise be on the streets getting up to no good. This sometimes raucous night of singing, rap and comedy is designed to remind them of their roots and their culture.
I mean, there's nothing better than being back home where you belong, because even I, living here for like over 10 years right now, I'm still an outcast. This is not my country. This is not my world. My country right now is Somalia, but it needs to, you know, be fixed. And until then, I'm a foreigner here.
When I was young, the police used to pick us up. I've even got put into a bully van myself, which is a police car, and I've got battered for no reason because I was a Somalian. The only thing he was saying, you effing Somalian, and he was punching me in my face. I mean, when we tell the police this, they're not going to believe us because it's their word against our word, and they're not going to believe us. And there's no one we can really turn to and say, look, we need this help.
The organisers of this event say that more funding is needed for community initiatives such as this, to make young Somalis feel wanted and to give them some direction in life.
I think the only way to break that cycle is to communicate better, both from the Somali community and obviously the law. They need to find a way to meet halfway. You know, obviously, I can't say every Somali person is clean and, you know, has no record and is good, but same as I can't say every Somali person is bad either. So I think they need to find that common ground where they're able to understand each other.
I'm Somalian, end of the day. I'm Somalian. I'll always be a Somalian. But by papers, I might be something else. So what I'm trying to say is, end of the day, whatever, I know that I'm going to be going back home. If I don't, I know my kids will be. So that's what we're trying to tell them. Don't forget what you are.
And that's your ultimate goal, is it, to go back home?
Yes. I would do anything to go back home, especially when it's peace.
MI5 don't make public statements, so they won't respond directly to the accusations levelled against them in this programme. However, they do say that Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism is the main threat to Britain's national security. They also specifically deny targeting Muslims, arguing that Muslims themselves are victims of Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorism.
Seen from the British government's and the security services' point of view, British Muslims are the most susceptible to the kind of ideology which saw 52 people killed on July the 7th, 2005 in London. The kind of ideology which thirsts for revenge for Britain's invasions of two Muslim countries in the last decade, and its support for dictators in the Muslim world as well as for Israel. More recently, the killing of a British soldier in South London in May 2013 pose serious questions about the ideology of British Muslims who try to travel to Somalia, as the chief suspect allegedly did. But Michael Adebolajo also had contact with the security services, indicating that those who attempt to travel to Somalia are closely watched and perhaps also recruited.
Well, let's be clear what the responsibilities of the security service are. They are to counter terrorism. There are several other responsibilities. Their task is to identify potential suspects, and then when there is sufficient evidence, to place them under surveillance, and ultimately to save lives. It's not just saving lives in the United Kingdom or elsewhere, it's saving Muslim lives as well.
MI5 clearly believes that Britain faces a growing threat of terrorist attacks from UK residents trained in Somalia, a failed state where Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups have the space to thrive. They estimate that over 100 British residents are training in Al-Shabaab camps to fight the Western and African Union-backed governments. But MI5 is concerned that it's only a matter of time before these highly trained fighters come back home to attack British interests. And it wants to act before this happens rather than after an attack takes place. During the course of this documentary, I've had quite a few problems penetrating the Somali community, despite the fact that I'm a Muslim myself and I've got a track record of making sympathetic films about Muslim communities in the UK. There seems to be quite a lot of concern and distrust about the way that Somalis are portrayed in the media, and there also seems to be quite a lot of fear of speaking out, because if you do that, you might be targeted. For all the Somalis that agreed to appear on camera for this documentary, many more refused because they feared being targeted. Yet off the record, they all confirmed that the community feels harassed and intimidated, and that can only store up problems for the future.
Once you come camera and you said, I'm going to talk about terrorism, they will say, no, if this can get me into trouble, if I say anything, the police may come to my house. And said, we know what you say. I don't think that's a good idea for the Somali community. I think they should come forward and speak up. But I can understand their concerns. I can understand how afraid they are.
The feedback you receive from people who have been victims or people who had interaction with the police or the security services, it's certainly that, you know, what we can say is that this is not helping the social cohesion agenda at all.
There's also a sense of frustration that the authorities just aren't listening to the Somali community's concerns. And that is why some members of the community are finally going public. Their reasoning is that the softly, softly approach has failed, so now it's time to speak out.
I mean, if a young Somali was approached by the security services and didn't want to talk to them, what advice would you give to that young Somali?
I'd say, look, contact a lawyer. And there are many lawyers in this field who will give advice. There's an organisation that I advise called Cage Prisoners. We deal with these situations. But certainly do not deal with them on your own. And also, you know, if you feel we're constantly harassed, there are avenues of complaint available.
I spent the last few months with the Somali community in the UK, and I've been researching their relationship with the British state. And my impression is that it's a long way from the Al-Shabaab stereotype that some commentators like to portray. Yes, they do suffer from the same kind of problems that deprived immigrant communities in Britain suffer from, such as low-level crime, deprivation, Islamophobia and racism. But they also seem naturally religiously moderate and therefore not susceptible to extremist Al-Qaeda-type ideology. That said, there is a war raging in their homeland, and some young Somalis may feel that it's their duty to go back and fight. Some of them might end up fighting for Al-Shabaab. But does that justify the British state casting the net so wide that effectively they're targeting a whole community? I don't think it does.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. In the Limelight.
A spokeswoman for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has confirmed that the Florida governor will continue to fly migrants to Illinois and Delaware. We have taken a look at some of the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on the story. The Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, plans to continue flying undocumented migrants to Democratic strongholds, his spokeswoman said on Saturday, a day after release records showed the state paid nearly $1 million to arrange two sets of flights to Delaware and Illinois. Documents released on Friday showed that the planned flights will transport about 100 migrants they were scheduled for before 3rd of October, but were halted or postponed. The contractor hired by Florida extended the window for the trips until 1st of December, according to memos released by the State Transportation Department. Asked why the flights were postponed, Ron DeSantis's communications director, Taryn Fenske, said Florida had been busy dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Ian. While Florida has had all hands on deck responding to our catastrophic hurricane, the immigration relocation program remains active, Taryn Fenske said. The flights would be a follow-up to 14th of September flights from Texas to Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, that carried 49, mostly Venezuelan migrants, to the island where the former President Barack Obama owns a home. Local officials were not told in advance that the migrants were coming. The Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, claimed responsibility for the flights as part of a campaign to focus attention on what he called the Biden administration's failed border policies. He was joining the Republican Texas governor, Greg Abbott, in sending migrants to Democratic strongholds without advance warning. Ron DeSantis is also thought likely to run for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024. Earlier this year, the Florida legislature approved a $12 million budget item to relocate people from Florida to other locations throughout the United States. The money came from the interest earned from federal funds given to Florida under the American Rescue Plan, legislation passed to help states recover from the COVID pandemic. While the migrant flights to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts originated in Texas, the charter plane carrying them made a stop in Florida. Ron DeSantis has said that migrants' intention was to come to Florida. The documents released on Friday gave no details of how migrants were recruited in San Antonio, Texas, for the Martha Vineyard flights, or who was hired to conduct that part of the operation. The Martha's Vineyard flight has also spawned lawsuits accusing Florida of lying to the migrants to get them to agree to the flights. The New Yorker magazine has more on the same story. A couple of weeks back, The Economist published a long cover story on the disunited states of America, detailing how, on issues such as abortion, guns, voting rights, and immigration, America's red and blue states are engaged in a new politics of confrontation. As if on cue, Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, who often seems as if he is campaigning to succeed Donald Trump as the nation's provoker-in-chief, staged his latest political stunt. Using Florida taxpayers' money to charter two planes to fly about 50 undocumented migrants, mostly from Venezuela, to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Ron DeSantis was not even relocating the group from his own state. The flights originated in Texas. The authorities in Massachusetts moved the migrants to the mainland on Friday. And as the migrants settle into the military base on Cape Cod, there are still myriad unanswered questions about the flights. Who exactly organized them? Were any Texas officials involved? What, if anything, did federal immigration authorities know about the maneuver? And were they even legal? In drawing up Florida's state budget for 2021-2022, the Republican-controlled state legislature allocated $12 million of interest generated from unspent COVID relief funds for the transportation of migrants. But the legislation said this money would be used to move unauthorized aliens from this state, not from Texas. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, Rachel Rollins, said she's looking into the legality of the flights, and Gavin Newsom, the Democratic governor of California, has called on the U.S. Justice Department to explore the possibility of bringing federal kidnapping charges. Ron DeSantis, who's currently running for re-election, remains utterly unrepentant about exploiting as political props a group of migrants, some of whom were apparently misled into thinking that they were headed to Boston and told they would receive jobs and housing. He glibly framed the move as an act of service. "We're not a sanctuary state," he said, "and it's better to be able to go to a sanctuary jurisdiction. And yes, we will help facilitate that transport for you to be able to go to greener pastures." Of course, Ron DeSantis isn't the only Republican governor to have dispatched undocumented migrants from red states to blue states. He seems to have got the idea from Texas's Greg Abbott and Arizona's Doug Ducey, both of whom have been sending busloads of migrants to Chicago, New York, and Washington, D.C. on Thursday morning. Two buses dropped off about 100 migrants outside Vice President Kamala Harris's official residence. The Fox News Channel reported that they, too, were mostly from Venezuela and had been picked up in the Texas border city of Eagle Pass. In discussing the recent escalation in tensions between Red America and Blue America, The Economist noted, "Echoes here of the tussles between southern and northern states in the final years of the antebellum era." But the magazine also stated flatly, "America is not going to have another civil war, as some feverish pundits speculate. That is a debate for another day, but what is abundantly clear is that the migrant stunt has provided a preview of the 2024 presidential campaign, in which Ron DeSantis is likely to feature prominently. In trying to position himself as a viable conservative alternative to Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis is using emotive issues such as immigration and abortion and school curriculums to raise his national profile as a culture warrior. His strategy reflects the makeup of today's Republican Party. As my colleague Benjamin Wallace Wells pointed out in a piece earlier this week, on the midterm elections, focusing on culture war issues enables the GOP to energize its electoral base of white voters without college degrees, and also to gloss over the growing chasm in the party between those actively supporting Donald Trump and his big lie about the 2020 presidential election, and those trying to maintain some semblance of independence.
Hidden Files.
100 years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare. Not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in this show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years. And now, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists, they're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran, 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing, you know, the good and the bad, and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S. to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s on a host of different nations like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism are people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions and often die as a result.
But let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice de Zayas. De Zayas is an expert for civil and political rights and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He has been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Oh, welcome to the program, Mr. de Zayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad. That cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s, and the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impact of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, et cetera, et cetera. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the, shall we say, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I make in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice. Because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
But what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say, and what Richard Falk says, and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes, as the spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred Dozeas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive and, for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us right here next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Joseph Borrell's neocolonial comparison and funny claim that Europe is a garden and elsewhere is a jungle, of course, fails to notice the West's decline caused by elites like him. Borrell, of course, had closed his eyes on the political instability in the UK and the election results in Sweden and Italy when he was making such remarks. However, making such remarks has its roots in the racist and colonialist nature of European leaders. In this regard, we have provided worldviews about this issue. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT in an op-ed wrote, Joseph Borrell, the European Union's foreign policy and security chief, gave an important speech to the European Diplomatic Academy in Bruges, Belgium, in mid-October. Being amongst fellow members of the global elites, Borrell felt able to set out his views on the relationship between Europe and the West and other nations with an unusual degree of honesty and candor. Borrell declared, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything works. It is the best combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that the humankind has been able to build. The three things together. But, warned Borrell ominously, the rest of the world is not exactly a garden. Most of the rest of the world is a jungle, and the jungle could invade the garden. How then was this unwelcome prospect to be avoided? The solution was simple. According to Borrell, EU ambassadors, who he designated as gardeners, had to go to the jungle and impose on it the ideological, political, and economic agendas of the globalized West. The garden could not sit by idly and do nothing, cautioned Borrell. A nice small garden surrounded by high walls in order to prevent the jungle from coming in is not going to be a solution. Because the jungle has a strong growth capacity, that wall will never be high enough in order to protect the garden, Borrell claimed. Europeans have to be much more engaged with the rest of the world, otherwise the rest of the world will invade us by different ways and means, Borrell advised. Borrell's speech was immediately slammed and criticized harshly by a few left-wing politicians in Europe, as well as some non-European states, most notably the UAE, on the grounds that it was racist and rooted in colonialism. Those criticisms are valid as far as they go, and Borrell grudgingly offered an apology of sorts, saying, I am sorry if some have felt offended. Nevertheless, he stood by his basic metaphor, reiterating that, regrettably, the world in which we live today looks more and more like a jungle and less like a garden. But much more serious criticisms can be legitimately leveled at Borrell's crass worldview. Censures that go well beyond the obvious fact that it simply seeks the reeks of 19th century Eurocentric prejudices. First, let us start with Borrell's extraordinary Polinia-like assertion that in Europe and the West everything works and that the garden nations are havens of political, economic, and social stability. This pronouncement will no doubt have come as a surprise to many citizens in Europe and the West. Has Borrell not noticed the recent rise of powerful right-wing political movements in a number of European countries? Is he not aware of the recent election results in Italy and Sweden? Have Borrell's advisors not informed him of the political instability that has engulfed the UK in recent months, let alone the crisis in democracy that has crippled the United States for the past 2 years? Has Borrell not noticed the dramatic recent rise in energy prices, rising inflation, rising interest rates, long-term wage stagnation, and the looming economic recession that is predicted to engulf many Western nations in the near future? Has Borrell not seen the tens of thousands of demonstrators marching in European capital cities in recent months? Is he unaware of the effects that EU austerity programs have had in many of the bloc's member nations in recent years? Does Borrell really believe that the garden nations will sail through the upcoming European